Well, we are in the third and final Sunday of what we are calling Jump Month. Each morning we have gathered together and we have talked about a different place that as individuals and as a church that we are seeking to jump into. And that very first week we talked about the idea of jumping into a lifestyle that is marked by us following Jesus. Not simply believing, but following Jesus. Last week we talked about the importance of jumping into relationships that are marked by courageous authenticity. This morning we're going to look at a third place that we are jumping, but I'll get to that in a moment, because something else that has taken place during this series is each Sunday I've been able to come in front of you and have a little bit of public confession about an addiction in my life. You see, as you've come to know over the last couple of weeks, I have a strange addiction to nature shows. I confess that boldly before you. I don't tend to look for nature shows on purpose, but when I stumble upon them, when I'm channel surfing, I'm stuck. I could be watching TV, commercial comes on, grab the remote. A gray wolf. And I'll be stuck there. I'm stuck there until it gets to a commercial or until I find out what happens to the gray wolf. And not too long ago, I'm watching TV, commercial comes on, and a gazelle. There was a gazelle. And then this gazelle was swimming across a river. And I've watched enough nature shows to know that rarely does the animal planet show a series on the migratory habits of gazelle. Whenever you see an herbivore swimming across a river in East Africa, you're alerted that this is probably predator week on Animal Planet, and something bad's going to happen to the gazelle. And so I'm watching, and this gazelle, in this case, is doing rather well. In fact, this particular gazelle is yards away from the other side. And at that moment, there is this white bird that gets startled on the banks of the river, and it takes off. And when the bird takes off, the gazelle freezes. Yards away from shore. He's almost made it, and he... Now, this is a great sermon illustration for the importance of keep going, don't stop, but that's not where we're going this morning. It's just, and I noticed that there was what appeared to be a log or some type of wood in the river that is floating, but this particular piece of wood is floating against the current. I'm going, oh, Mr. Gazelle, do you ever talk to the television? I do. It's embarrassing for my family. But this is one of those moments like, oh, gazelle, you got to move. You got to move now, buddy. You're about ready to become lunch. Go, go, go. But he doesn't listen to me. And sure enough, it's a crocodile. And the crocodile grabs a hold of the gazelle. It's a Nile crocodile, second biggest crocodile in the world behind the saltwater crocodile. A Nile crocodile routinely 13 to 15 feet long, weighing 1,000 pounds, but Nile crocodiles can grow as long as 20 feet. And if you have trouble visualizing 20 feet, that's from that chair to that chair. That's how big a Nile crocodile can get and can weigh 2,000 pounds. And this 2,000 pounds is muscle, armor, and teeth. And it is a killing machine, and it grabs a hold of this gazelle and starts to drag it under the water to the point that you only see the gazelle's head, and I think, he's done. He is crocodile lunch at this point. But at that moment, a strange thing happened. A hippo starts making its way towards this little feeding moment. You need to know this about hippos. Hippos are big. Hippos are 7,000 pounds. If you don't understand 7,000 pounds, that is over 1,000 pounds more than a Chevy Suburban. And this 7,000-pound hippo, and by the way, hippos, tremendously territorial. They're aggressive. And they can run 30 miles an hour in the water. And this 7,000-pound, you know, Chevy Suburban hippo goes charging up the river and goes after the crocodile. And at first I thought, he's just being territorial, doesn't want anybody having lunch in his part of the river. But then a second hippo joins in and they both go after the crocodile. And they're going on top of the crocodile until the crocodile goes, this is bad. I didn't hear him say that, but you can understand what he's thinking. And the crocodile goes, and at that moment, I'm going, wow, that was impressive. But then I watched as one of those hippos turned and walked alongside this gazelle until the gazelle made it to the riverbank and ran away. And I'm just looking at this hippo going, that's one remarkable hippo. And now I'm just intrigued by this idea of, you know, hippo angels or something. And so I go on YouTube and I type in hippo and crocodile because I wanted to see this again. And then I sat back. I was in my office, and Ruth can attest to this, because I'm sitting in my office going, on YouTube, hippo, crocodile. There is video after video after video after video after video of hippos rescuing other animals. They rescue wildebeest. They rescue antelope and gazelle. They rescue zebras. There's one. I kid you not. You can look this up. There's a little baby zebra, abundantly cute, trying to swim across a river, but the current is too strong, and the current is forcing this little baby zebra downstream, and a hippo comes out, gets downstream for its protection, and guides it to an outcropping of rocks. And once the little baby zebra's on the rocks, the hippo stays with it until it regains the strength needed to continue the journey. And I'm sitting there in my office going, Jesus is a hippo. Now you're understanding why Ruth sometimes goes, Mike, Jesus is a hippo. Jesus comes and rescues me because I'm in bad shape. Left to my own, I'm dead. Wages of sin is death is what it says in Romans. Left to my own because of my insecurities and my sin and my struggle, I'm toast if not for Jesus. Jesus on the cross showed that he's willing to run or jump into places where there is danger and where someone is struggling so that me, the gazelle, is set free. And I'm sitting there going, Jesus is a hippo. And I was so proud of the analogy that I drew there until the Spirit of the living God spoke into my ear and goes, excuse me, Mike. Jesus is a hippo, but Jesus wants you to be a hippo. That's not nearly as fun. I was really excited about this idea of Jesus rescuing me, but this idea that I'm supposed to be a hippo, that's a little more difficult. If you have a Bible, open it up to the 13th chapter of John. I know on your bulletin it's got a different verse, but we're going to be in the 13th chapter of John. And the 13th chapter of John happens to be one of the most remarkable passages in all of the Bible. I'm going to have it up on the screen too. You can use the Bible that's underneath the seat. But as we look at the 13th chapter of John, we come face to face with something that is beautifully disturbing. 13th chapter of John starts out this way. We'll be taking a couple different parts of it. It was just before the Passover festival. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Now, at the very end, when it says he loved them to the end, depending on the translation you are using, your Bible might say it this way: he now showed them the full extent of his love. Now, as the reader here, if you ever read that, and now pay attention, Jesus is now about to show the full extent of his love. That's the part, as the reader, you really want to pay attention to, because apparently the Apostle John, who is one of Jesus' closest disciples, is able to identify a moment where he's going to show, quote, the full extent of his love. The evening meal was in progress, and the devil had already prompted Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with a towel that was wrapped around him. Culturally speaking, this is an absurd moment. Culturally speaking, 2,000 years ago in Israel, it was common for a guest that came into a home to have his or her feet washed. They wore sandals. Their feet were dirty. But the person that washed the feet was the one at the lowest rung in the social order. The person that washed feet was the servant, was the slave, was the child. Within that cultural context, that's who washed feet. Jesus, in this setting, is the rabbi. He is surrounded by his disciples. He is at the top of the social order in that gathering. And here's Jesus, the one on the top rung of that cultural ladder, and he goes all the way to the bottom, takes off his outer clothing, gets down on his hands and knees, and begins to wash the disciples' feet. If you skip ahead to verse 12, when he, Jesus, had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I have done for you?" he asked them. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Very truly I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." And this happens to be one of the most routinely ignored portions of Scripture. If you need evidence to such a statement, answer this question: how many sets of feet, other than your own, have you washed this past year? Now, at that moment, this is where we say this: Mike, that's not what Jesus was talking about. He's not speaking literally here. He's speaking figuratively here, which is interesting to me because the rest of the instructions that go in and around the upper room, we tend to follow literally, like the whole Last Supper thing. We do that, but we don't do this. Even though Jesus clearly says, "I have shown you what you're supposed to do. Go do that, and you'll be blessed if you do it." Interestingly enough, some of the greatest moments of personal blessing in my life, some of the times that I have experienced the intimate power of God most wonderfully, have been in moments of foot washing. During our staff and leadership team retreat, we closed our staff and leadership team retreat by washing one another's feet. But we don't do this, mostly because it's weird. It's kind of gross, and we have feet issues. And so we ignore this rather clear teaching of Jesus. But, benefit of the doubt, let's just say that Jesus is not speaking literally here. He's speaking figuratively. I happen to think he's speaking in both ways. I think he's giving us a clear instruction, but he's also giving us a larger command to humble ourselves before other people. And so maybe I have to change the question. In what ways are you routinely jumping at opportunities to humble yourself before somebody else and serve them? Especially the person that, socially speaking, is deemed less than you. In what ways are you doing that? Because if you go to the end of the passage, picking up in verse 34, Jesus says, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another." Greek word here that is translated as love is agape. There's four different Greek words that are translated as love. This one is agape. The best definition of agape I've ever heard is this: to intelligently and intentionally do what is best for someone else. To intelligently think about this, plan, and intentionally create time and space to do it. To intelligently and intentionally do what is best for someone else. With that definition in mind, this is how this verse reads. Jesus says, "A new commandment I give you. intelligently and intentionally do what is best for others. As I have intelligently and intentionally done what is best for you, so you are to intelligently and intentionally do what is best for other people. All people will know that you are my disciples. All people will know that you are my followers. All people will know that you are Christians, not by what you say you believe, but when you intentionally and intelligently do what is best for other people. That's the commandment Jesus gives. Of course, this isn't a radically new idea. In fact, if you read through the Gospels, Jesus is talking about this throughout the Gospels. He says things like this: in the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. And the crowds asked him, what then shall we do? And he answered them, whoever has two tunics is to share with him who has none. And whoever has food is to do likewise. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. Truly, I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers or sisters of mine, you did for me. But of course, if we get caught up in this mindset of the God of the Old Testament is radically different from the God of the New Testament, which is somewhat heretical, consider what happens in the Old Testament. Therefore, you are to love the foreigner, since you are foreigners in the land of Egypt. And it's so sad when our politics trump our scriptures, and we allow some issues to be only to be talked about in political space and not in the church. Stop doing wrong and learn to live right. See that justice is done. Defend widows and orphans and help those in need. I'll tell you what it really means to worship the Lord. Remove the chains of prisoners who are chained unjustly. Free those who are abused. Share your food with everyone who is hungry. Share your home with the poor and homeless. Give clothes to those in need. This isn't my opinion. This is what the scriptures say. This idea of being hippos is throughout the scriptures, that we are to be a people that when we see need, when we see gazelles in trouble, that's where we go. That's what we do. We jump at the opportunity to be hippos. And so this last week when I was studying, I came across a quote that disturbed me in a wonderful way. This person said, Jesus did not go around being good. He went around doing good and releasing all who are oppressed. What has he anointed you to do? Jesus didn't go around simply being good. We usually define being good by not doing certain things. Jesus went around not simply being good. He went around doing good, releasing those who were oppressed. What has God anointed you to do? If you read through Christian history or church history, there are a few moments, and I was a history major in college, so this really gets me excited, but there were a few moments within the last 2,000 years that God worked in and through the people of God. God worked in and through the church, and as a result, there was an explosion with the gospel. One of the key moments in church history takes place in the 2nd and 3rd century in the Roman Empire. It's in the 2nd and 3rd centuries in the Roman Empire where there were epidemics. You could almost call them plagues within the cities of Rome, Alexandria, Antioch. There were these plagues, these epidemics that were so severe that some historians say that close to 2,000 people a day were dying. The best medical minds in the Roman Empire were unable to fully grasp what was happening, but they were able to understand that contact with the sick was dangerous. So what did the doctors do? They left. They go, you stay here, you die, we leave. And they weren't the only ones to leave. Everyone who had means left. People with means, people that had money, people that had, you know, influence or were prestigious by the cultural standard, they left. There were caravans of people leaving these cities. Interestingly enough, some historians would say this is the beginning of the suburbs. to say it. But the people left the cities, except for one group of people. Those crazy Jesus followers. The Jesus followers that were in the city stayed in the city. In fact, some of the Jesus followers that were outside the city, as the caravans were heading out, they headed in. One historian wrote this: instead of fear and despondency, the earliest Christians expended themselves in works of mercy that simply dumbfounded the pagans. For them, God loved humanity. In order to love God back, one was to love others. God did not demand ritual sacrifices. He wanted his love expressed on earth in deeds of compassion. And for these Christians, their compassion was practical. They bathed the sick. They gave water to the thirsty. They fed the hurting. And as a result, many people that were too weak became stronger and they were able to live. But for those that died, and people continued to die, these Christians did something that was culturally unheard of. They buried the pagans right alongside their own. And the world took notice. And the Church of Jesus Christ exploded in all the right ways. As in part because of these people that were being hippos. A few years ago, I was invited to go to World Vision. World Vision is headquartered in Federal Way, Washington. I lived in a town that was about 30 minutes from there. And there were a couple people at our church that were on staff with World Vision. They invited me to come to chapel. World Vision does chapel every week on their main campus. So I said, absolutely, I would love to come to chapel at World Vision. And so I got there, I found a seat, and it just so happened that the president of World Vision, Richard Stearns, was the one sharing that day. I go, what a treat, all right. And I'm just sitting there, and he got up and he announced to the World Vision staff of a partnership they were forming with what he called this little denomination. This was the first time that World Vision had corporately aligned themselves with a single denomination to do work. He goes, we have formed a partnership with this little denomination called the Evangelical Covenant Church. If you're new here, that's us. We're part of the Covenant Church. And he said, we are partnering with them to make a difference in the Democratic Republic of Congo, statistically speaking, the poorest nation on the planet. So we've partnered with the Evangelical Covenant Church to do something in Congo. And then he shared a story. He said, we were sitting in a conference room, you know, some World Vision types on one side and the covenant folk on the other side. And he goes, I hated to do it, but I had to. So I asked the covenant representatives. He said, pardon me for asking, but when the going gets tough in Congo, what assurances do we have that you're not going to bail and leave us holding the bag? Fair enough question. To which one of the representatives of Covenant Church, a woman, looks across at Richard Stearns and says, we have been in the Congo for over 75 years. During one of the uprisings in Congo, when everyone was told to evacuate, our missionaries remained until the point that it became so dangerous that a sympathetic police officer gathered these missionaries and brought them to police headquarters for their safety. And they were hiding there until the rebels surrounded police headquarters. And they were calling out, are the missionaries in that building? The police officer told them, just stay here. He walked out and met with these rebel leaders. He goes, there are no missionaries in this building. There was a pause, and then there were gunshots as the rebels gunned down the police officer. The missionaries that were inside police headquarters thought, we're next. But a strange thing happened. The rebels did not come into police headquarters. In fact, the rebels ended up dispersing. The missionaries stayed there for a little bit. They looked at one another, they prayed, and they returned to their villages to continue their work. Let me ask you, Mr. Stearns, what assurances do we have that when the going gets tough, World Vision isn't going to bail? And I'm sitting there in my seat just doing this little happy dance going, those are my people. Those are hippos. They see a need and they go. Yes, the crocodile is big. Yes, the crocodile is dangerous. But the hippos go because they realize that hippos are more powerful than crocodiles and our God is more powerful than anything else we're going to meet. They go. I routinely read blogs. There are a couple blogs I read because I really respect the person that's writing. Others I just read just out of curiosity. And I came across a blog recently that was called The Art of Manliness. The title enough grabbed my attention. Art, manliness. And I go, attaboy. And so I'm just reading what this blogger is saying in The Art of Manliness. This is what he writes. When we think about moments that epitomize manliness, we often think of the captain going down with the ship, the men who allow the women and children to go first, the soldier who throws himself on a grenade to shield his brothers from the blow, the old man who attempts to save a drowning child and perishes himself in the waves. The common denominator in such scenarios is this: sacrifice. Sacrifice is arguably the manliness of virtues, the manliest of virtues. It is the ability to give up our desires, sometimes even our lives, to aid and benefit someone else. While most of us will never be called upon to make the ultimate sacrifice, there is one sacrifice every man is both capable of making and should be making: the sacrifice of his time and resources in the service of others. Part of the warrior's code that every soldier lives by is, I will never leave a fallen comrade. Thus, in the heat of battle, when someone cries out, "Man down!" the troops mobilize to get their fallen comrade to safety. A medic or other soldier will brave the hail of bullets to save their comrade. There are a lot of men down these days. They're wounded on the battlefield of life, not with bullets, but with poverty, illiteracy, and hopelessness. As part of the brotherhood of man, we have an obligation not to leave our comrades behind. As the saying goes, the public service we render is the rent we pay for our place on earth. He's calling us to be hippos. And obviously, this isn't just a man issue. Every man, woman, and child is called to be a hippo. There was a young man who was inspired by Mother Teresa, and so he wrote Mother Teresa a letter. And in the letter, he said, "How can I make a difference like you're making in Calcutta? I want to live a life of significance. What advice do you have for me?" Months go by until a letter arrives at this man's home, and he can see it's from India. Mother Teresa had written him back, and in the letter it contained four words: "Find your own Calcutta." Find your own Calcutta. Mother Teresa was called there. She was called to be the hippo there. Where are you called to be a hippo? Where are you called to live a life marked by the willingness to sacrifice so that others might live? Where are you called to be a hippo? As a church, we desire to be a group of people that are following Jesus, that are living lives of courageous authenticity, that are living hippo lives. I got a text from Alicia. I told her, "Hey, you're going to be in my sermon." Alicia is on staff here, and she oversees our new programs with preschoolers and the mothers of preschoolers. And she was sharing with these preschool moms about some of the needs that exist from the fire victims around here. And so she sent me this picture. So they heard about it, and these moms all said, "Let's be hippos." You probably don't want to say that to young moms, you know, but they've got an inner hippo in them. And they did. They just responded. "We can help." Some of you might know that I am now on the coaching staff at Rockland High School. I am one of the coaches for their women's basketball program. And for me, that's my Calcutta. That's where I can go and I can serve people. And I had somebody go, "Well, how is your coaching going to impact your pastoral responsibilities?" And my response was, "How is that not part of my pastoral responsibility? As a pastor, shouldn't I be a hippo? I go. Now, as a church, I know that there are many of you that have a whole lot of hippo in you. You jump at the opportunity to serve. A need comes up, you respond. It's one of the things that makes this place beautiful. But we also recognize that sometimes we need a little help. Hey, here's an opportunity to be a hippo. And so as a church, we're trying to create more and more opportunities for you. You don't have to go to Calcutta. You need to respond the way you are. So here's a couple of ideas for you. The Gathering Inn. Quarterly, we host the homeless here. And we don't just simply put out a soup line and give them a room to sleep in. Oh no, we pamper them. We pamper them. I know that this Wednesday, we're having it. It's not too late to sign up to help. There's signups out in the lobby. You can still sign up to help the Gathering Inn. I hear it's an Italian theme. We're going to have violin going, the whole deal. And we get to just have them as our guests. And we're going to love on them. We're going to be hippos. If you go on the website for the city of Rockland, if you've never been there, we live here, check it out. There's a whole section on there for volunteering. You can go on there, click on it, and volunteer your time for the city of Rockland. In fact, I know that this Saturday they're having a cleanup open space day, and you can sign up for it. What would happen if, I was thinking about this, your small group went online, found out a way to serve in our community. Let's, as a small group, go do this. And so as a small group, on one Saturday, you go and you're serving. There are going to be other people that aren't Community Covenant people, and they're going to ask you, what brings you here today? To which you can respond, we want to be hippos. And they're going to look at you like you're nuts. For all, I think sanity is a little overrated to begin with, but you just had an opportunity to share with them, this is why we do what we do. We follow Jesus, and Jesus serves, and so we want to do the same. There's a school across the street, Parker Whitney Elementary School. We are slowly going to be building a team that is designed just to help every person here bless them. Our goal is by the end of the school year, every person that's part of this church will be able to go, this is how I blessed them. We've already given packages to the teachers. Some of us went and did a prayer walk, and we're going to be coming up with other ways that we can hippo them. And yes, I just made hippo a verb. Operation Christmas Child is something that we have done at this church for years. It is huge. Unfortunately, we have nobody that has stepped up to lead it right now. So there's a chance that our screen will look more like this. But if some of you feel like, hey, no, this is a chance for me to serve. I want to do this. We can talk with Ruth, talk with me. We'll get you started. And then finally, 3, 2, 1. With our threes, we get to hippo them. It is our pleasure to hippo them. It is an honor to be able to hippo these people that God has put us in a relationship with. With our twos, those people we're mentoring, you get to hippo them. What a privilege to be able to do that. I was watching Stephen Colbert the other night, and he was interviewing a man by the name of Heath Evans. And Heath Evans is part of an initiative that wants to eradicate extreme poverty in the world by the year 2030. Water for everyone. How do we get water? How do we get immunizations? How do we get mosquito nets? Those kind of things. And as I'm listening to him speak, there's a part of me goes, it'll never happen. It'll never happen. I go, wait a second. I thought God was big. And then he said something that just got me fired up. I was about ready to go to bed. And after I heard that, nope, I'm up for a little bit longer. He said, I can find the quote. He said, we don't want to be a generation of bystanders. We don't want to be a generation of bystanders. We don't want to be a generation of bystanders. Bystanders stay on the shore and watch the gazelle die. Hippos charge and rescue the gazelle. Bystanders tend to flee Rome when it gets difficult. Hippos go into Rome. Bystanders are very comfortable staying in police headquarters where it's safe. Hippos go back to the village. Bystanders are comfortable just taking care of themselves. Hippos say, God did not give me a spirit of timidity, but a spirit of power, of love, and of self-discipline. Where you send me, I will go. Here am I, Lord, send me. I'll leave you with the words of John Wesley. John Wesley said, do all the good you can by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as ever you can. I'm going to invite the worship team to come up. We're going to sing one more song. And the song we're going to be singing, we introduced here at the church back in February, and it's called When the Saints by Sarah Groves. Sarah Groves took that classic song, When the Saints Go Marching In. She took that idea, and then she filled it with more contemporary examples. And she says, I want to be like them. It's a hippo song, if I've ever heard one. So won't you please stand, and we'll sing this song together.